Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, live from the annual meeting 2024 in Milan.
Listen up, people. It's an all points bulletin from SBGAN. And the podcasts are now going to come to you three times a month, on the 1st, on the 10th, and on the 20th. A podcast every 10 days. Can you believe how lucky you are? Anyhow, we're now going to have a live or a near-live presentation from Milan with Dr. Elena Cernat of Leeds, who is our chef extraordinaire. I say she's the chef extraordinaire because she's gone through the menu of all the abstracts to be presented at the annual meeting. That's 1,433 accepted abstracts, if you're interested, from more than 5,300 delegates and 104 different countries. That's a lot to go through. And frankly speaking, we've watched you, we know you, we don't think you're capable of sorting them out on your own, and that's why the chef has decided to give you the menu degustazione, or menu de degustation, or tasting menu, or the omakase, which means non prevescelte de parte del cliente, which means you, the guest, have no choice. Dr. Cernat has picked out to offer us, her guests, seven abstracts of particular interest. The first, Dupilumab in children with eosinophilic esophagitis and prior use of swallowed topical corticosteroids, results from the EOE Kids study by M. Cejade et al. Of Mount Sinai, New York, University of Rome, and Western University, London, Ontario, is paired, a sort of a diptych, with Dupilumab improves caregiver-reported eosinophilic esophagitis symptoms in children aged 1 to less than 12 years with EOE. 16-week results from Phase 3 EOE Kids study. First author here is M.E. Rothenberg. And another contributing institution is Children's Hospital Medical Center of Cincinnati, Ohio, together with Western University of London, Ontario, and the University of Rome, of course, in Italy. Elena, why these two? Why together these two?
Thank you, Alex. It's really lovely to see you again, and this time in Milan. Such a great city with an amazing cuisine to go on your note. I try some beautiful and very good food in the last evenings. Anyway, to go to the point, why Dupilumab? So I really choose these two abstracts because it's extremely hopeful for patients, but also for us as clinicians to see new therapies emerging, therapies that can improve patients' health. We know that the prevalence of eosinophilic esophagitis is increasing yearly. It's a rather difficult to treat condition with high recurrence rates. So having another therapeutic option, it really sounds optimistic. So another point for me, it's a learning thing because I don't really have any experience with this drug. It's not approved to use for eosinophilic esophagitis in children in UK. So as you said, both abstracts are from the EOE Kids study. And the first one was looking at the efficacy of the drug with higher and lower exposure regimes compared with placebo in patients 1 to 12 years of age that have not responded to PPI. They included a fair number of patients, 102, and they noticed that at week 16, Dupilumab led to improvements in histological, endoscopic, and symptomatic aspects of EOE versus placebo, regardless of the use of swallowed topical steroids, that is the standard treatment, the results being better with a higher exposure regime. The second abstract focused on the impact of Dupilumab on the EOE symptoms like dysphagia, nausea, vomiting, pain, reflux symptoms. And they use a score, the pediatric eosinophilic esophagitis symptom score. And again, when they compare with placebo at week 16, again, they notice an improvement in the symptoms mentioned, again, better with a higher exposure regime.
I take that that's all important. So what should we know about the new agent? How does it work in EOE and in other atopic conditions?
Thank you for the question. I think it's really important for us as clinicians to know how a drug is working and what is the mechanism of action when we prescribe it. So dupilumab, it's a fully human monoclonal antibody that blocks the intercellular signaling of the interleukin-4 and interleukin-13. And we know that these two interleukins are driving the type 2 inflammation that plays a crucial role in atopic dermatitis, rhinoconjunctivitis, rhinosinusitis, asthma, and of course in eosinophilic esophagitis. And we see the effects that are pretty fast. This study was talking at the effects at 16 weeks, but if you look at other studies in atopic dermatitis and other conditions, it's even faster. They see effects at 2 weeks. So I think it's a good medication.
And how long is it going to be continued? How long does it have to be continued?
Unfortunately, I can't really answer this question because, as I said, I don't really have experience with the drug, but I'm imagining it will be a long-term treatment and we really need more data to see the results of the drug.
There's all the other usual questions about what happens when it's withdrawn, do people relapse, and is it the sort of thing against which one develops antibodies so that it no longer works in particular patients? But those are all material for the future, you say?
I think so. I think with all these new drugs, we just have to wait and see, really.
Well, is it allowed for use anywhere in Europe or only in the North American area?
So it's approved in North America, and I think in other countries it's used in trials. But as I said, the UK, unfortunately, we can't. I think we are trying now with compassive use to see if there is any scope for that.
Okay, well, here we are outside the restaurant, our noses pressed up against the glass, and all the people inside are eating without any difficulty because they don't have eosinophilic esophagitis. It's so unfair. Keeping within the food metaphor here, you understand. Our next abstract, our third, from the Faculty of Medicine and the University Hospital of Köln in Germany, is therapy de-escalation in pediatric patients with inflammatory bowel disease in remission. Characterization of phenotype, treatment, and course. Data analysis from the CE Data Registry. I hope that's not pronounced SEDATA. I've never come across the word before. And the first author here is Sila E. Tsekin. This looks interesting just because we're not told a lot. We don't know about a lot of what happens when the inflammatory bowel disease calms or even goes away. How do we titrate the downshifting from full court press to, I guess we're just on maintenance now?
Exactly. So, as always at Espagan, I have noticed a great interest in IBD with really high impact research. But this one catch my eye exactly because I was talking about de-escalation instead of escalation. And I think as doctors, we are not so good in reducing treatment sometimes.
You're right. We start, and is it enough? And if it's not enough, we add some more. And is it enough yet? No, we add some more. But when do we pull back?
Exactly. I think sometimes, you know, a patient has a stormy course, it's sick, you made him feel better finally, he's well. Do you really want to rock the boat? But it needs to be done. So that's why I found this abstract really interesting. So as you said, the study looked at real-world data from this database that it's a large patient registry in Germany and Austria over a 20-year period, so a long time. Had its limitation, I could say. So it was a retrospective study. They looked a long period of time, and sometimes the management of IBD has changed during this time. But from the 230 patients that received combination therapy with an immunomodulator and a biologic for at least 6 months, they saw that the de-escalation was successful in 64, so 28% of the patients. They noticed that de-escalation was more successful in patients with Crohn's disease compared with UC, in the patient with less severe UC compared with extensive disease, and also it was better to de-escalate to a biologic rather than an immunomodulator or to stop completely the medication.
And how do you handle these patients at your institution?
So, in my institution, we are trying as well to de-escalate. But as I said, I think this study had some limitation. I think the main one is that they haven't mention which biologic these patients were on. So, yes, I think that was an issue. So we all know that the patients are doing better on monotherapy with adalimumab. It's an anti-TNF agent, that with infliximab, another anti-TNF agent. Because with infliximab on monotherapy, it's more likely to develop antibodies. And again, I think another important point, once you de-escalate, so you stop the immunomodulator, it's really important to do serial autoantibodies to see if the patient is losing the response to the medication, because that can happen if you stop the immunomodulator. So as I said, I think there are some limitations there, and I think this study needs more work and improve the data. But I think, as I said from the beginning, it's important to talk about de-escalation and to start doing it, maybe more frequent than we are doing it now.
Before we become too censorious, too critical, we have to remember these are abstracts. They don't include all the data. And I'm sure that when a manuscript is finally submitted for publication, it will address some of the perceived deficiencies that you've pointed out to us.
I'm hoping so, because I think it will be really useful data for everyone that it's involved in the care of IBD patients. So, yeah.
Well, we've had a little bit about inflammatory bowel disease. We've had a little bit about inflammatory esophagitis. And let's move on to infant feeding. Infant feeding. Our fourth abstract from Mahmoud et al. Of University College London in London, UK, is titled, Does Infant Feeding Influence Later Appetite Traits? Oh. In other words, if you bring up a child in the way he should go, will he later depart from it? That's in the Bible. Tell me more.
So I choose this abstract as I found the results pretty interesting. We all know how important and beneficial breastfeeding is for the child's health. And a World Health Organization study from 2019 involving 16 countries and 30,000 children showed that breastfeeding can cut the chances of a child becoming obese by up to 25%. So that is impressive. Yes. But nevertheless, it wasn't clear what was the mechanism for this to happen. So this study, that was a multi-center randomized controlled study, the OptiGrow study, looks at how early life exposure to nutrition can program the development of appetite traits. They use an eating behavior questionnaire for babies and one for children to measure appetite behaviors. They found that infants who were breastfed ate at a slower rate and had less enjoyment of food than those given formula.
So this doesn't talk about individual food preferences. It talks more about speed and volume of eating. And a breastfed child is not going to persist so long in eating and is going to take less food. And there we have an underpinning for the observation that breastfed children grow more slowly and reach generally lower weights over a particular period of time than do their formula-fed peers. Well, how are we going to work with that? Well, we need... where do we take this from here?
So I think one of the explanations of what this is happening is that breastfed babies, as you said, can regulate exactly what they are eating from birth. And we all know, so it's thought, that formula-fed babies have more difficulty to recognize satiety, and also this could lead to overeating and sometimes an excess of protein and energy intake. So I think that could be one of the explanations that for this study. Of course, I don't think this is the only mechanism, like to relate the breastfeeding with obesity. We all know also that, for example, the microbiome plays an important part. We know that the breastfed babies had a healthier microbiome, and we know that there is a relation between microbiome and obesity, so probably this is another mechanism. But I think the conclusion of this is that it's really important to promote breastfeeding worldwide, but even more in countries where the rates are really low, like UK, for example. So I think we have to do better with this, really.
What is the rate of breastfeeding in the UK?
I think, if I remember well, I think at 3 months, it's around 17%. This was a study from 2010, if I remember well, but it's still, it's low.
17% of mothers have stopped breastfeeding their babies when the baby is 3 months old.
Yeah, they start, so the start is good. So I think 80-something percent, but after a lot of people leave it and it's not really good. So I think we have to work more with this.
There's a lot that needs to be done, including more support for mothers.
Exactly.
Less need for mothers to return to work immediately. A great deal that is outside pediatric gastroenterology and nutrition, but has a great effect on what can be done within that discipline. Another aspect of nutrition, of course, or alimentation, is whether or not the children can use the food that they get. And one substantial set of infants who can't use the food they get are infants with short bowel syndrome, who've had some sort of catastrophe, whether intrauterine or thereafter, that has reduced the total length of functional small bowel. There's an agent available to deal with that. It's called teduglutide, if I am pronouncing that correctly. Anyhow, this agent capital T, long-term capital T treatment in children with short bowel syndrome, a real-life multicenter retrospective study of patients treated for more than 1 year. Why did you pick this one up?
As you're aware, my special interest is intestinal failure, so...
Oh, I forgot that.
Yes. And only last year I started to use this drug in my patients with really good results. But I'm really interested in the long-term effect of other countries that are using it for longer. As I said, in UK was approved by NICE recently. As you mentioned, this was a real-life multi-center retrospective study involving patients from 7 countries and looking at the efficacy and safety of teduglutide in long-term users. From 103 patients, 69 received the drug for more than 1 year. The ones who responded had more bowel length and a smaller daily output. It was very positive to see that 34% of them, so a relatively good number, were completely weaned of parenteral nutrition. And some of them, 5%, responded to the treatment even after 1 year, with some, as expected, losing the response. There were some several adverse events recorded also, and some of these were related with the drug.
Well, don't stop here. Tell us what they were.
The problem is they didn't really talk about this in the abstract about the adverse effects.
At least they didn't say that nobody, at least they said nobody died. We can
infer
that.
Okay. Yes.
Well, here we have a very expensive agent, a very boutique drug and an expensive boutique drug. Are they going to ever be able to withdraw this drug?
Good question, and probably nobody really knows the answer at the present time. The data on effects after discontinuation, it's really, really limited. I remember I have read recently a paper from Poland that was looking at the effects up to 9 years after discontinuation. And initially, there was an increase in the PN needs for the first year after the requirements remained stable for 2 to 3 years to increase again. But the number of the patients in this study was so low that it's really, really difficult to draw conclusions. I think what is happening at the present time, many centers are just continuing the drug. In some other countries, because of the cost, they stop it. But we really need more data to have some response to this. And I think also we need more data in the adverse effect, because if you lose a drug long-term, probably there are more adverse effects. And I think another point that I will make, it's the discomfort of the patient. So currently, it's a daily subcutaneous injection. From my experience, from my patients, sometimes can be painful, but I think this would be remediated soon, as I think the companies are working on a slow-release medication or a slow-release drug.
Our hope has to be that the changes induced by the agent with increased mucosal area are permanent, that the gut is remodeled. You're shaking your head. You say they're not permanent.
No,
they go away.
Yes, exactly. So once the studies, the trials for now, they show that once they stop the drug, the effects are disappearing also. So that's why it's used long term.
Well, a bit of a disappointment, but there's always a next generation drug around the corner.
Definitely.
Fingers crossed.
I think it's really positive and optimistic to have this drug for my patients. Was a life changer, really.
Wonderful. Marilixabat. How come I can say that and I can't say any of the other drug names today? Marilixabat is an ileal uptake of bile acids blocker. And by altering the dynamics of the enterohepatic circulation of bile acids, by reducing the quantity of bile acids presented to a liver that is not handling them well, it can improve the liver's ability to deal with what it is getting. Marilixabat impact on concomitant medication use for the treatment of cholestatic pruritus and Alagille syndrome, a real-world experience. That is, if you're not damaging your liver with an excessive influx through the gut of bile acids, then can you cut back on the other agents that are used to handle the adverse effects on the liver? What did they find? Oh, sorry about that. This is from R. Howard et al. R. Howard and other authors, and was sponsored by Miriam Pharmaceuticals in the USA.
Yes, so it's interesting because last year in the same podcast, I think I spoke for the first time about the IBAT inhibitors like Marilixabat and how impressed I was with the effects they were having in cholestatic patients. It seems that the research in the area is continuing with the study, looking at real-world data of how by using this medication, other concomitant treatments could be stopped. The study showed that Marilixabat can significantly reduce polypharmacy burden within the first year of treatment.
I think that's wonderful, and yet it doesn't really help me with a possibly more important question. And that is, does administration of Marilixabat lessen or only slow the rate of accumulated liver damage caused by excess badly handled bile acids? We would possibly profit by comparing beginning of treatment and at some point into the treatment, repeated liver biopsy to examine whether or not, compared with historical controls, fibrosis is slowed, scarring is slowed, and the eventual progression toward portal hypertension of clinical importance is slowed.
Yeah, definitely. I think that will be a good point for study in the future. I am hoping the ones who are doing these studies will think about it, because it's a really important question. For now, what we are seeing, it's improving the quality of life of the patient, because I definitely think it's positive to have less medication that can be a really burden for families, for patients. And also, I think sometimes by reducing the pruritus, they will have less morbidity, mortality related with surgeries, for example, like biliary diversion or transplant. But as you said, I think we don't really know if this could slow or even reverse the progression of liver disease. So your ideas are very good for future studies, definitely.
Let's hope that somebody picks it up and runs with it. 7 out of 7, our last abstract. Long-term maintenance of response and improved liver health with Marilixabat in patients with progressive familial intrahepatic cholestasis. 2-year data from the March On study. That's Alex Mithka's work, and not just his work, but 28 at least additional institutions and collaborators went in on this with him. And Alex is based at the Children's Hospital Medical Center in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it would be tedious to list all the others. I have my doubts about this study. Improved liver health. When I think about PFIC, I think of the most serious complication as hepatobiliary malignancy, whether hepatocellular carcinoma or cholangiocarcinoma, which occur with increased frequency in the first decade in patients, particularly with PFIC type 2 bile salt export pump deficiency. If this ileal uptake blocker actually reduces the amount of injury is it reducing it in a permanent manner, or is it only shifting the time curve so that instead of tumors showing up in the first decade, will they show up in the second? What implications does this have for long-term care and, again, really long-term care in these kids?
Good question. Again, I'm not sure if anybody knows the answer at the present time. Anyway, the study what showed is that mararixibat improved the pruritus, serum bile acids, and total bilirubin, and also the growth in this patient. And this effect is long-term, like 2 years. So in my opinion, if it's improving the things like bile acid, total bilirubin, and the effect is long-term, probably the risk of end-stage liver disease and hepatobiliary malignancy is less, but maybe it's just delayed, as you said. As I said, I think we'll know this answer in some years' time, not really right now.
So far as I can tell, this study does not stratify the patients studied by type of mutation, particularly in BSCP disease. It's PFIC as a lump, and we're not told if it's PFIC type 1, PFIC type 2, PFIC type 3. All that work that's been done to differentiate among types of PFIC seems to have been thrown out the window for this abstract.
Yes, they talk about the broadest range of PIC types, but not separating in them, from what I can see.
And within those types, not separating them by mutations that abrogate function entirely, or mutations that only slightly impede function. We need more data before we can provide more funding, Dr. Methke, and we need it more precisely detailed for us. But it's lovely to have these preliminary results available. That was a lovely, lovely meal. And as I sit here with my toothpick, my clothes slightly loosened to accommodate all of that which I've taken on, I wonder, have you picked a... You spoke about Italian cuisine as one of your reasons to visit Italy. Well, we all know that the Italians invented food. So this is the place to do some serious eating. Have you got anything to share with us that celebrates that particular aspect of life in the EU?
Oh, so the food is amazing, but also the music. I think we have a very nice song. Lasciatemi cantare.
Lasciatemi cantare. Let me sing.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you, Elena.
Thank you very much, Alex. Lovely to see you.